Concession number 28766.
Anthony took rail 2. Could you describe a bit more about the deck landings?
Well, we went out to France in the August, and of course we got chased back by the Italians, and the August did a quick turn and came back to England or Britain, and we came back by the blue train, but it was crowded with people coming up from Italy, people who were caught down there on holiday, or people who had houses and lived down there and came back. They had all the seats in the train. We joined the train at Marseille and found we couldn't get a seat. We were sitting on our cases. And we had everything with us. We carried everything with us all the time, because I mean, we didn't know where we were going. I was sitting on a case, and the French chap who was in charge of the, I suppose you call him the head, what sort of chap who normally sits in the guards van, he known as the, I suppose he was known as the guard, I don't know, but he came along and told us we've got to get off our seats, our suitcase and things out of the corridor. Well, I said, you tell us where to put them, in my worst French. But he did speak English, and he was insisting we've got to. So I said, well, you move them, and then we'll follow. But he hadn't got any idea where we could go. All the seats were taken. People were overflowing into the corridors, and we had to. And we sat on the seats, on these makeshift seats, all the way to Gare de Lyon the next morning, and stayed there for the night, feeling very tired. And then found that we were due to go back to Dover by old folks, and I forget which, by a French. What was she called? Maidenboard, or something like that. And she wouldn't sail after dark because of she's frightened of torpedo boats and things. So we had to wait all night, again sitting in a chair, while I sat in the chair as best I could. And next morning at daylight, then she sailed. I think the British ships were sailing all night and didn't worry too much about them. They were more, thought it was more important to get everybody back to England than it was to be scared of anything they might meet on the way. And that was the end of my training. And then we split up. I found myself going to 826 Squadron, the first of the Albacore squadrons. Supposed to be to replace the Swordfish. I liked the Albacore. The engine wasn't terribly reliable because it was a sleeve valve engine, and nearly all the aircraft we lost were due to engine failure. We lost a lot of aircraft and a lot of crews at Bertrand Newton in Norfolk, where we went to help the RAF who were doing the East Coast convoys. I stayed in 826. Eventually we took her out the middle of the Atlantic and down to Freetown, and then on to Cape Town with three darn great troop ships, the Worcester, the Suffolk, not the Suffolk Cruiser, the Suffolk merchant ship. I forget the other ones, but they were that type of soldiers. You could see the soldiers all through the tropics lying in their shirts, in their shorts. They really were. I wouldn't believe I was told how many troops there were on board. But they weren't allowed off shore until they got to Cape Town, and then they were allowed ashore. And the WVS, what we call them, WVS? Yes, Women's Voluntary Service. They hadn't got the R in front of them, and then they came later on when the Queen and the King said they should be the Royal Women's Royal Voluntary Service. There were more volunteers for cars to take chaps out around the Cape, sightseeing and so on, then there were off-watch chaps who fill the cars. They were fantastic. And you weren't allowed to spend any money. They paid for everything. And it was all spoilt when an Australian convoy went through. And I think these Australians, whose fathers and not grandfathers, certainly fathers, had a very keen fighting spirit during the First World War, and these chaps were determined to maintain that, and they behaved very badly, and for a time they weren't allowed ashore at all if they were going up to the desert. But we couldn't, we did get ashore. I think we had 2 days there, and then we left, and we took on board an intelligence officer, and then we weren't aware of what we were going to do. But it was bombing the Italians in Tanis Somaliland, which I think was called Eritrea, and Mogadishu was one of them. What was the other one? I suppose Addis Ababa. No, that was ashore, wasn't it? No, that wasn't. One of the chief. I'm not sure whether Addis Ababa was the capital of Haile Selassie's outfit. He was evacuated by the British, and until about a couple of years or 3 years, he was all his family were parked down in Bath, I think, or Bristol, or something like that, until they thought it was safe for him to go back. And we had a chit written in Arabic, which you were supposed to hand over if you were caught by the local chaps who would hand you over to the friends of the great Lion of Judah. And some of them even had a gold coin attached to them. We didn't. Mine was just in writing, which I've still got in the desk. And the only chap to be shot down there was landed eventually about 20 or 30 miles up the coast from Mogadishu, and landed on the beach. They couldn't get any further, and then started to think in terms of destroying the aircraft. And they were picked up by a gang of these local boys, and when they showed them these gunichis, as we call them, they couldn't read. They were useless. So they kept them entertained by gradually stripping bits off the aircraft, and they were in bits, and handing to them own things, you know, a bit of a machine gun, but not enough to do it. And to understand what it was all about. And also accidentally dropped bits and pieces over the side, over there in shallow water. And fortunately, just when they were beginning to get tired of thinking of other ways of keeping these boys happy, an Italian patrol was looking for them and picked them up, which was lucky. They thought that they couldn't think of any more things to keep the little boys happy. And they were in prison for not very long. I think they were in prison for about 4 or 6 months, something like that. And a very senior observer we had, called Harth, Pinky Harth, he wrote out on a piece of signal pad and wrapped it up in a cloth with weight on and dropped it over the town of Mogadishu and asked for it to be handed to the British prisoners who were taken week before. And they did. And Pinky said, even in wartime, it shows that chivalry is still possible. It was February 1941. We were in Cape Town. We were in Freetown in Christmas 41, and instead of having Christmas dinners, as it had all been arranged for everybody on board, a convoy was attacked over on between the Azores and the American coast, or South American coast, but I'm not sure. My job was a bit vague. And a ship called the armed cruiser called the something Castle, Pretoria Castle, who had been turned over to the Navy for an armed merchant cruiser. She turned up a few days later with a hole right through her funnel. She was still chugging along. And we had to spend our Christmas Day taking the bombs off, which we'd used for anti-submarine bombing, and putting torpedoes on in their place. And we spent nearly the whole day doing that, and then didn't have to use them. Because the Hipper-class Pocky battleship, for some reason or other, didn't press home the attack on the convoy. And I don't know where they went or why they didn't press on the attack, but anyway, the Pretoria Castle came into Freetown, and we picked up the three troop ships and carried on down to Cape Town. And, that was our Christmas. When I got to, we were up in the town of Somaliland, weren't we? And
was this your first operational?
No, first operation was, I remember well, it was a Tuesday in the May before Dunkirk, from Bertram Newton, Norfolk, where we flew down to. Oh, we had a week in Jersey, in Guernsey, Jersey, and then the Jerseyites, am I kicking your control? Jerseyites were very cross because we kept them awake at night with our night flying, which we'd probably gone there for. And within a fortnight or 3 weeks, I bet they weren't complaining to the Germans, because we cleared out. Flew back to England in a hurry, and the Germans actually took over St. Bernard's Bay Hotel, which was our mess. And they improved it tremendously. We went there, I remember, sometime after the war, and it was all beautifully done up. And they put this chap who was almost bankrupt, this Jerseyite, on his feet again. And they must have spent a lot of money on their Oxford mess. Her first operation was bombing Calais before the real start of Dunkirk. I think Dunkirk was about 5 days, wasn't it? Something like that. And we did one operation bombing the Germans who were advancing up the Newport. And Gravelines, which almost joined Scalo. And our job was to bomb any German vehicles we saw trying to cut off the troops from Dunkirk. That was our first operation.
What resistance did you meet? What resistance did you meet?
Well, practically nothing. Nothing at all. One chap swore that he had blown up a German staff car, but how he knew it was a staff car, I don't know. But anyway, that was his story. It was a good enough story. We had another gadget, which I had to go up to Coventry, to the arms factory there, one afternoon, and pick up a secret weapon, which was an enormous great length of tow wire, I think, it may have been rope, I can't remember, but it seemed to be reeled of it, and took those back to Detling, where we were for those Dunkirk days. And the idea was that they worked a flare on the tail end of this thing and towed it up and down the channel. And if the flare showed up any German gunboats or torpedo boats, the other aircraft which are flying higher would come in and bomb them. Well, it didn't quite work like that because Dunkirk finished before we really had a chance to try it out. But the idea was all right. I didn't do any of the towing. I got to Coventry and back, I remember having to start my own engine up there because you had to start Swordfish on turning an inertia wheel. Usually two chaps, two of your ground crew, got it spinning, and the pilot thumbs up and switched on, and you hope he caught on. But it was hard work for one person. I couldn't get anyone to help me up at Coventry. I suppose they were all far too busy to worry too much about a Swordfish wanting to start. Anyway, we got going, got back. I remember we slept in chairs that night because Dunkirk, Detling, and Manston were packed tight with fighter aircraft. And we couldn't find anywhere to mess, and so somebody had the right idea of getting in touch with Joe Lyons. And so we had a huge marquee belonging to them erected, or they erected it. And they had easy chairs in there. So the Morris country able to sleep in there. And I think, don't think we ate it. I think we went to the mess for food. Yes, we did, because the RAF messing people in the RAF mess sent us a bill for the food. Well, I rang a chap up and said, look, I didn't choose to come down there, and I don't think I have to pay you this bill. And he said, well, you can ring up later on. I'm a prisoner under the table. I've been bombed. And what happened after that was that anybody who could call in on journey somewhere just went into the mess, had food, stayed the night. Unless he drank stuff you had to pay for anyway, you didn't get receive a bill. It was reckoned, it evened itself out all through the rest of the war. So that was saved a lot of bother and a lot of paperwork and everything else.
After France fell, after Dunkirk and after France fell, what sort of operations were you
North
undertaking
sea convoys.
Against the
North Sea convoys and also you either flew convoy patrol, and they were boring as hell. And you just went round and round and round. One Albacore, quite a bit close to the Commodore convoy where you're supposed to identify yourself. And I think he was. We had to have swordfish for a time because the Albacore had to go and be modified, have sleeve valves modified. So they went away one aircraft at a time till we got the whole 12 back. And so he was in a string bag, and the Commodore, the senior officer of the convoy, I think was this Black Swan, said, if you hadn't been an ancient biplane, we would have shot you down. And so this midshipman said, and if you'd thought you were aiming at us, we should have felt quite safe. I didn't get a reply. But another one said, when at the end of the patrol, he said, I'm due back in Durban, I'll rush you. That's quite a lot of that sort of chit-chat, but there's nothing else going on. I don't think anybody ever sighted, one aircraft sighted a floating mine. And I don't think the Navy were particularly worried about it, because it wasn't in their route. And if they just dispatched one of their own escorts, which were very few, we hadn't even got the 16 American, the 50, 1916 vintage American coal-burning four-funnel destroyers, which we were given by Roosevelt. We hadn't even got them then, because they didn't come in until, halfway through the war.
What sort of height would you fly up over the convoys?
Oh, well, in good weather, you could fly a couple of thousand feet. Bad weather, you got to the height where you had the best visibility you could. And sometimes we got these fogs coming in off the wash, and we didn't have any RT then, it was all WT, so you couldn't speak to anybody, you just relied on the observer in the back tapping meshes out. And so some of these fogs came in pretty fast. I got caught up one night, and I could get the coast all right. That was no trouble at all. The fog didn't proceed. It was once you reached the coast, the fog came down, but it was much worse there than it was out at sea. So we follow the coast up and down, up and down, up and down, around Cromer and that sort of area. And not knowing quite what to do. And then, obviously, one of our team actually got through to the Bertrand Newton base. And they switched on their searchlights. And where they pointed to, we went down through the fog and managed to find the runway.
Were you flying in protection against attacks from sea or air? Went over the convoys, were you protecting against attacks from sea?
Always the idea was the Germans would be using high-speed torpedo boats dashing up the convoy, and then after they attacked the convoy, turn around and go back. Well, they never did that. Nobody ever answered why. I don't think, well, once the convoy was got through the very dangerous part of the Dover Straits and so on, they were in comparatively safe waters. I don't think anybody ever saw a U-boat or anything. We did meet an albacore, which was quite extraordinary, because when we left Jersey, we had two aircraft. I think one had done a bit of a bumpy landing on this little grass field that they had just had. Previous to that, they landed on the beach at... I can't remember the name of the beach. That was where Jersey Airways used to land, and they built this grass, little grass meadow, really, what had been, turned that into a landing field. It was perfectly all right, nothing wrong with it. But we did have an aircraft in the hangar in bits and pieces. And it was due, it couldn't be, it was, it would have been, another couple of days they could have flown it out. Well, the woman in charge of the catering on this airfield had said that she was anti-German, and while she was born and bred in the Channel Islands, she wasn't going to leave and she'd blow the whole thing up. Well, she was pro-German. And we met this albacore being repaired, not me personally, but some other chap met it over a convoy. But it was all a bit of a fun, really. I mean, he didn't say intention of shooting it down, and I'm quite sure the Germans intended other than just have a bit of fun with an albacore. We never saw it again. Now, that was the most boring part of the patrol work we did during the war, I think. Except we did know we were going back home to a bed that night, whereas when we were convoying later on in escort carriers across to Argentina and Newfoundland, I believe you're supposed to call it, Iceland and Newfoundland. I never had to do a Russian convoy, but Jeff, who did last week, he was a Russian convoy pilot. But the Russian are extraordinary people. Mrs. Churchill organized reinforcements for the civilians in Russia. And they were all sitting in the ships waiting to join the convoy to Russia, and the Russians would let them proceed. Nobody understood why. Another ship, which an RAF chap told me this, he was an engineer, and he was accompanying a squadron of Hurricanes up to Russia because they said they were short of fighter aircraft to protect whatever the place was. but they had to. They went in bits and pieces, and were being put together at some airfield south of Petersburg, I suppose. And they, when they got there, they found all the wheels had been pinched by the local farmers and so on. An extraordinary crowd. So there was nothing, none of these aircraft ever got, became operational. And you can imagine a rubber-tired hurricane wheel just about right for some form of a farm implement, a wheelbarrow or anything like that. They were extraordinary people. Now we used to go across from Iceland to Newfoundland. There was one odd sort of, we were day out from Iceland, Reykjavik, and we collected our convoy and we were in pretty good weather, good weather as this. And a Liberator, was it a Liberator? Or one of the big German, the big American aircraft, came from astern and ditched. So the pilot picked up, and he was a civilian ferry pilot. We used the same sort of, anybody who would fly an aircraft was sent to fly Dakota or something other, but back from America. And he said, "Why did you ditch? You were only stone's throw from Reykjavik." "Oh, well, we didn't know that. We didn't realize we were so close to land as that." And we saw the convoy, and we saw the escort carrier, or the carrier with it, and we thought, they always have to fly into wind. Well, natural fact, of course, we had the wind up our tail. And I was the most extraordinary thinking on his part. So he ditched. He thought that was the safest thing to do. He was picked up by one of the escorts. And we met up with him in Argentia, in Newfoundland. And he didn't get very kind thoughts from us over that. Just shows how ignorant some of the ferry pilots were.
Remember when that was?
What?
Do you remember when that was?
Oh, yes, that was when did we start convoying? I would think that was 1942, probably, or 43. 40, might have been 43, I don't know, 42 or 43.